the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Dave Pablo.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. Today we're talking with Michael Sussman, Green Party candidate for New York State Attorney General.
Then author Diane Cameron joins us in anticipation of Memorial Day to discuss Never Leave Your Dead, her autobiographical book about military trauma.
Afterwards, WOOC correspondent and engineer Jonah Moberg will be speaking with Ayed Al-Karabi about queer Palestinian empowerment.
And later on, we'll speak with Jesse Marshall and Ryan Rose, co-owners of the Capital Bookkeeping Collective, about an upcoming workshop on sociocracy. Let's start the show off with some rapid-fire local headlines.
In New York City, alleged serial rapist and former film producer Harvey Weinstein has been arrested on charges of rape and sexual assault. His lawyer, Benjamin Braffman, seems confident that an American unwillingness to believe women will be Weinstein's saving grace. He says, "I anticipate that the women who have made these allegations, when subjected to cross-examination, will not be believed by 12 people." Weinstein's accusers have expressed more confidence in his conviction. The music industry entrepreneur Drew Dixon, one of Weinstein's accusers, told the New York Times today that, quote, "I hope that it sends a message to men who are still walking around thinking that they can get away with it, that it can catch up."
An Amber Alert was issued today regarding a 14-month-old boy reported missing after his 18-year-old mother was found dead in the woods near the farm where she worked. The woman, Selena Hidalgo Calderon, was an asylum seeker from Guatemala and had been in the U.S. since 2016. The Post Star reports that she may have been fleeing immigration officials before she died. Her missing child, Owen Hidalgo Calderon, was last seen on May 16th.
The Alt reports that four Troy police officers, Justin Ash, Christopher Parker, Louis Perfetti, and Kyle Jones, have been accused of savagely beating a 50-year-old African-American man, Lamont Lee, in a March 3rd incident. The accusation comes as Lee's lawyer, Michael Feit, is filing to withdraw a guilty plea that Lee made after being hit and kicked and punched in the head during his arrest, and then being denied medical attention until after his plea. Video from a local business appears to corroborate Lee's account. Following the motion to withdraw Lee's guilty plea, Troy police officers allegedly approached Lee and his grandson in a parked car, displaying drawn weapons and three dogs, dragging them out of their car, handcuffing them, and forcing them to the ground without arresting or charging them in. Officer Nick Laviano, president of the Troy Police Benevolent Association, has said that he is confident the officers did their jobs with the utmost professionalism while dealing with Mr. Lee.
Government meteorologists are predicting an average hurricane season this year, after last year's active season. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration forecast calls for 10 to 16 named storms, with 5 to 10 hurricanes. 1 to 4 hurricanes could be quote-unquote major, with sustained winds of at least 111 miles per hour. The National Hurricane Center predicts that a subtropical or tropical storm will develop in the Yucatan this weekend, affecting Cuba, Florida, and much of the Gulf Coast.
In bug-related news, tick season is here, and experts are urging caution to prevent tick-borne illness. A report this month from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that tick-borne illnesses have increased 30% in the last decade, in part due to increasing temperatures caused by global warming. The state of New York is set to increase their efforts to combat Lyme disease this year. Last week, Governor Cuomo announced a plan to combat the increase in tick-borne illnesses, involving efforts to reduce tick populations, increased education efforts, and the development of new tests that can allow potentially infected people to identify the disease. A New York Senate task force on Lyme disease is pursuing legislation that would improve education about Lyme disease for medical professionals and potentially force insurers to cover Lyme disease treatments. In happier bug-related news, the capital region's wild blue lupin is soon to be in bloom. A healthy lupin season is necessary to support the Karner blue butterfly, an endangered species of butterfly native to the region, with a stunning blue coloring. The Karner blue butterfly has become extinct in Canada and has endangered the U.S. due to development and industrial agriculture.
Troy will begin its fifth attempt at redevelopment of One Monument Square in June, with four design workshops to solicit public comment about what should be built on the former City Hall site. The first meeting will be held June 18th to provide an overview of the four proposed projects that never made it past the planning stage, which include mixed-use developments and a chain of multiplex cinemas. The next three nights, June 19th, 20th, and 21st, will be spent obtaining insights from residents and businesses about how they would like to see the 1.2-acre site developed. The space has been used informally as a parking lot since City Hall was demolished in 2011. ostensibly to create space for new development. Information about the public comment sessions will be available at troynewyork.gov. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. Next, Michael Sussman is a longtime civil rights lawyer who has recently gained the Green Party nomination for New York State Attorney General. WOOC correspondent Jonah Moberg met with him to learn more.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for being here.
Good to see you. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, you too. So you're running for Attorney General on the Green Party ticket. Could you talk about your background and why you wanted to run for that position and for that party?
Sure. So I got out of Harvard in 1978, and I joined the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. I was litigating around the country major civil rights cases. Ronald Reagan became president, and his attorney general said that the priority was to protect white men. I left the Civil Rights Division and joined the NAACP National Office. I went there in May of 1981, a long time ago, and had responsibility for many of the major civil rights cases that the organization was doing between May 1981 and really for a period of many, many years. I started my own firm after I won the Yonkers case dealing with housing and school segregation. I won that case in November of 85 and kept working on that case until 2007. My career, 40 years, has been spent trying to vindicate and protect the civil rights of people across a very, very broad range of issues, whether it be special education, age, national origin, race, gender, whatever, sexual orientation. And the Attorney General position in New York is a critical position in terms of public advocacy. And I haven't seen the kind of advocacy I think is necessary. I also think the position should be more independent, not controlled by one of the other political parties.
Sure. Is that why you ran as a Green? Do you not see the Democratic Party as being firm enough in their stances on civil rights?
So I've been a Democrat my entire life and ran for county executive of Orange County, a fast-growing county in our state, as a Democrat in 2001. I was going to run again in 2017, but looked up and saw Democratic Party positions that I couldn't relate to on environmental issues, on civil rights issues, on tax issues, on pension issues, on many, many issues. So at that point, I started looking seriously at the Green Party, and about a week ago, I switched parties and was happy to get the nomination through Wilson Pakula, which is a special authorization, at the convention last week. The Green Party values are much more consistent with my own. In the last 20 years, I've been doing a lot of environmental litigation in our county and region, and again, that's a central issue in terms of climate change that the Green Party has advocated.
Sure. So what do you see the position of the Attorney General being in relation to environmental issues?
Essentially to protect the public health and welfare, to say it simply, and even where things are going on in New York State that other agencies think are fine, the Attorney General should independently take a view of them and determine whether in terms of his patron's patriae authority or her patron's patriae authority, those things are in fact good for the state, and if they're not, should be in court fighting them. We have CPV in our backyard in Orange County, a major power plant, which would contribute 10% to the toxicity in our whole state. The Attorney General has been passive and done nothing to prevent it, even though there was no significant environmental review, and the reviews that were done appear fraudulent. That has to stop. The Attorney General has to be, in terms of public integrity, at the forefront of dealing with that.
Sure. That's on a state level. I know Eric Schneiderman developed a reputation of being kind of loudly in opposition to Donald Trump and that those policies, and I wonder if you think that as an AG, you would also have a national voice and what that voice would be.
I would try to have a voice that was similar on those issues, but I think the real thing here is New York State is very corrupt. We have a cesspool, an intolerable cesspool in New York, and one party washes the back of the other. So some independent force is necessary to ensure that corruption ends, that campaign finance reform is finally passed, significantly enforced, and these other issues are addressed. So yes, dealing with Donald Trump is very critical. No one could ever doubt that on our side of the political ledger, without doubt. But the other problems that are in our state and are causing tremendous apathy among our people, and the people are right, both parties have been pretty similar.
Yeah.
There's no real choice. So I think the Green Party is important because it offers a significant choice, and for this office, that's true as well.
I want to move away from environmental issues for a moment, because we're in Troy, where police brutality and racial profiling are constant, like, in really huge issues. And at this point, the Attorney General's office is involved with local cases involving police brutality. And I wonder, If you have thoughts about how you would handle local cases of police brutality and what you think the state government's role is in these cases.
So I've been one of the foremost lawyers in the state dealing with police brutality for 30 years. I've represented 7 or 8 of the young people in our state who've been shot to death, including DJ Henry, a Pace University student, who was shot to death in October of 2010 by a police officer who jumped on the vehicle and started shooting within 1 second with no provocation. After that shooting, I came to Albany and met with then-Governor Patterson and demanded a special prosecutor be appointed because I thought that it was crucial that local district attorneys not have anything to do with prosecution of cases involving claims against the police. The reason for that is not personal. It's structural. Local law enforcement works closely with every district attorney in the state, and thereby those district attorneys cannot be expected to work on cases involving police misconduct, brutality, shootings. So I believe structurally it's critical, not just important, critical, that that be a state-level issue. I've been fighting for that for years. In fact, I was one of the ones who got the situation to be remedied somewhat, but I don't think the remedy is sufficient. I don't think it goes far enough. Right now, the AG is involved in cases involving police shootings and killings. That mandate must be broadened.
You've talked a bit about the Democratic establishment in New York, and I think you mean more broadly, too, just the political establishment being a cesspool. If you were attorney general, you would presumably have to work with these people. If your points of view are so divergent, how do you think that will operate?
I don't think I have to work with the people. I think I have to work for the people. I don't think I have to work for that crowd. I think if I were elected attorney general, it would be a stirring mandate for real change in the state. I realize that other elections are important. Howie Hawkins needs a certain number of votes, and I think his candidacy is highly progressive. Mark Dunleavy's candidacy and his challenge to the way pension systems are used in the state is highly significant. I'm in a little different situation. I'm running for a position, which is, there's no incumbent, first of all, and the judgment should be who is the best and most qualified person in the state running to serve as attorney general. And I think I have a strong case to make that I'm that person amongst the three who are running. So if the voters decide that, which would be a radical rejection of the two major parties, one never seen in our state before, I think the people in power would have to respect that election result and work with me. But I'm not so concerned about working with them as I am concerned about ensuring that they follow the law. And that's what I don't see happening, and extirpating corruption, implementing campaign finance reform, and the other issues we've talked about.
So where do you see Tish James, the recent Democratic nomination, as far as these issues go?
I see Tish James's acceptance speech as significant. She focused on Donald Trump, not on Mr. Cuomo. I'm more concerned about the corruption right now of Mr. Cuomo and the way he's functioned in that office and the fact that he's basically coddled up with wealthy interests in our state and represented them, as in the CPV case, the Legoland case, his major contributions from Crystal Run, which received a $25 million building grant after major executives contributed over $200,000 to him, his contributions from Curious Joel, a major theocracy in our county, and then his willingness to support legislation supportive of that theocracy. Those are my concerns. Tish James has never going to address those concerns. She rejected the party which initially supported her, the Working Families Party, because Mr. Cuomo told her, if you get that endorsement, goodbye. So she then rejected that party. She is not sufficiently independent to be attorney general for all the people in the state. That's my concern.
One other question involving Cuomo and the upcoming elections. What does it mean to you that Biden and Clinton came to endorse him so publicly?
It's a great question. Really good question. We spoke about it a little bit earlier today. What it means to me is that the Democratic Party is looking backwards. And looking forward is what we have to be doing. We have to have outreach to the younger generations for whom Clinton and Biden are really, honestly, relics. They're political relics. We know that Hillary Clinton engineered the defeat of Bernie Sanders, and she engineered that defeat through very malicious means. We know that as a candidate, she was very, very weak and didn't really project the values of the certainly liberal wing of the left wing of the Democratic Party. And we know that Mr. Biden is someone who is a very nice gentleman, but no one who we can really trust to significantly champion the values that we have. I think the fact that they were there is very indicative of a party that's backward-looking and not looking for real progressive champions for the future.
And then one final question in the minute or so we have left. Schneiderman had been investigating Exxon for their role in promoting climate change denial. Would you continue this investigation, and what else would you do as far as holding those kind of organizations accountable?
Well, first of all, I would broaden the investigation. I don't think it's endemic only to Exxon. I think it's an industry-wide phenomenon. Secondly, but probably for me most importantly, I would look around the state to see where the fracking infrastructure is being developed. And I would say, which this governor has not said, no attorney general has said, that is inconsistent with the declaration made in December of 2014 that New York State will not have fracking. It makes no sense morally or legally to say fracking is too dangerous from a health perspective and environmental perspective in New York, but it can happen 50 miles away in Pennsylvania and we'll create a fracking infrastructure to facilitate that. That's improper. I would focus on that as Attorney General.
Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
That was Michael Sussman, the Green Party candidate for New York State Attorney General.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. Next up, in the studio, we have Diane Cameron. Diane Cameron is an award-winning writer and journalist. She writes about the history and politics of addiction and mental illness. Diane is the author of three books, and her most recent, Never Leave Your Dead, explores military trauma, told through the lens of her stepfather's remarkable story. Thank you for joining us, Diane.
I'm really happy to be here.
Now, can you start off by reading us an excerpt from Never Leave Your Dead?
I'd be happy to. I'm going to read a little bit from the preface to the book, which gives a sense of how this all came to be. This is the story of Donald Watkins, the man my mother married when she was 70 years old. He was a Marine, a murderer, and a former mental patient. At first, I wondered, how could she marry this man? Today, I understand why, because long after his death, I loved Donald, too. But it wasn't love at first sight. 2 years after Donald's death, I was given a box of papers that were his, and my search for the truth of this tragic man began. Donald was not the only one with problems. Our family had many challenges, and over the generations, we took trauma and compounded it. But to my great surprise, as I undertook the pilgrimage to understand Donald, I was changed. We were not a military family, so I had to confront the misconceptions and stereotypes that I had about those who make a commitment to military life. I had to search archives and libraries and find experts to translate the facts of Donald's life, and I encountered revelations every step of the way. I found documents, reports, records, and ephemera, things like menus and baseball programs, bits of old film, and parts of American history that I never learned in school. I also found teachers. My most important teachers were a group of courageous men who were old, sometimes deaf or blind, but who had an abundance of fortitude, resilience, humor, and honor. These were the United States China Marines. I learned two important lessons from these teachers, both the experts on trauma and the men who lived it. First, trauma is not the terrible thing that happens to you, but what is left inside you because something terrible happened. And second, if something terrible happens to you, that is not the story. How you survive and how you love and are loved again is the story.
Incredible. Thank you so much. Can you tell us a little bit about what you went through discovering and finding the story of your stepfather?
Sure. One of the things to frame this is I've been writing about self-help and psychology, addiction, all of those things for many years. So I thought I knew something. I thought I knew about post-traumatic stress disorder and about trauma. And several years after Donald died, my sister called me. She had boxes of his paperwork, military records, things like that, in her garage. And she said, you know, do you want these? And, you know, as a writer, as a journalist, I always want old papers just to see what they are. And when they came, it was absolutely fascinating. And a piece of the backstory, my mother married Donald when she was 70 and he was in his late 70s. And after they were married, this is important, my mother was a very smart woman. After they were married, she sat down with my brothers and I one day separately, because she knew there would be a reaction. And she told us Donald's story, the piece we didn't know. We knew he had been a China Marine, which are U.S. Marines before World War II. We knew he had lived alone on a long time in a farm. What we didn't know is that Donald had come home from China, a young man, a young Marine, and murdered his first wife and her mother, and was institutionalized. In fact, there was What I later learned was he was never properly arrested. He was never diagnosed. This was in the late 40s, early 50s. And that was the beginning of my curiosity. How does that happen? We know that doesn't happen today. So what was going on there? And so that led me into that piece. The other thing that really fueled me was I knew Donald. I knew him as my mother's elderly husband, nice guy, older guy. So I had to try to reconcile, how could that guy, this old nice man, be a younger man who had murdered in cold blood two people? The other thing that I knew right away was that even now, lead stories in the New York Times, we see them, you know, a serviceman comes home, best neighbor, best friend, best employee. We're very shocked. They kill somebody, they attack somebody. And we say right away, is that a veteran? Is that trauma? Is that military trauma? We have an expectation now to frame that tragedy. In those days, and it's hard to imagine this, post-traumatic stress disorder didn't exist as a term. Trauma was not considered something. So I knew right away, I'm fascinated by language and economics. I wanted to go wrestle with that. And it took me years and years of wrestling and research to come to understand what had happened, and it had happened to many, many people.
This sounds like a really incredible process of grappling with that. Like that sounds so hard to fit into a mind, you know?
It was. Yeah. It definitely was. And, you know, I would wrestle and write for years, then I would hit a dead end and think, oh, like I'll never fit this other piece together. And one of the things that worked for me is technology was changing over the years. There was a moment where I was searching for two attorneys who had actually helped to liberate Donald. For years, I couldn't find them. I sent letters. And then one day at work, I Googled their names, and the places that they worked now were on the internet, and they popped up, and I could make a phone call and find them. So there were these little research gifts along the way, too.
Mm. I want to just... So it's so interesting to me to imagine a time before people understood PTSD. What kind of sense did people make of his actions at the time?
He was, I mean, it's interesting to think about the language, and that's one of the things that fascinates me, is the murders took place in Washington County, Pennsylvania, very small town. And Donald was, he committed the murders at home, and he called the sheriff, and they came and picked him up. And he was submitted to what was called an insanity commission. It was the family doctor and a town judge. And they, of course, those behaviors, he was immediately diagnosed a lunatic, which was a diagnostic term. You know, we're sort of like, we don't think of that language now. And he was driven the next morning to Farview State Hospital, the other side of the state, where he was imprisoned for almost 40 years. No paperwork, no diagnosis, no legal charges. And that's how the mental health system worked at that time. You could be admitted, but there was no expiration date.
This is such a broad question, but I mean, 40 years is a long time. And as you were speaking earlier, I was thinking, all right, the prison system is not known for rehabilitation. It's meant for confinement, really, as opposed to in certain other countries. But with the mental institution, what was the evolution of that? Was he basically stuck there for a long time until someone with perhaps a little bit more progressive viewpoint started to deal with him, or
It's a great question, because that was also one of those moments when I sort of discovered the actual circumstances that I thought, I'm writing this book no matter what, because people need to understand how it was so that we don't go there again. In fact, what he was committed to was considered a hospital. There was no doctor or medical staff at all in this hospital. So it was a prison. But that was the fate of many people with mental illness. One of the things that made me begin to admire Donald, even given these circumstances, and appreciate him, is that most of the other inmates or patients, if you will, were overly medicated, tortured, truly tortured in this hospital. There were sexual abuse games performed by the guards, gambling with human beings and human bodies. Later, the governor of Pennsylvania, after people wrote to make these accusations. The governor of Pennsylvania was turned away at the door of Farview and not allowed in, and he had to go back and get the National Guard. And when they did go inside the hospital, they found so many graves of, and they could tell that these people had been badly battered and beaten, starved. One of the abuses is that food trucks would come to the hospital every week, and it never came inside the building. The guards filled their cars. So the men were abused, overly drugged. And Donald had enough, it's extraordinary to me, presence of mind. At one point, he stopped taking the drugs and felt all the pain in order to get organized enough to facilitate his release. And what he did was he wrote to the law school at Penn. He wrote to a very famous psychoanalyst, Thomas Zaws at Syracuse, who was intrigued by the circumstances. And Zaws took on the case. And that was another one of those moments when I found the correspondence for Zaws. And I thought, you know, I've been in mental health field a long time. This is a significant player. And he's showing up in Donald's story. So I knew I had a couple of significant people coming together to do that. But the language, I just want to say something about the language, because we talk about trauma now for all kinds of things, car accidents, sexual assault, and it's just in our daily language, as is post-traumatic stress disorder. We know that what happens to humans' minds, bodies, psyches, of course, has always happened. So the question is, what did we call it? And there's a list that I'll share of the things we have called it over time. War neurosis, World War I, shell shock, World War II, trench suicide, railway spine, which is pre-World War I, soldier's heart, which is the Civil War, gross stress reaction, which is the first time the American Psychological Association acknowledged that there was a thing that happened. And two that are very interesting, it was the terminology was called nostalgia at one time, because the belief was that a soldier who looked back at family or tried to recall his family was weak. All of these diagnoses are about weakness. And the final one, which I think is the saddest, is called lacking moral fiber. This is World War I, the beginning of World War II. It was LMF, was stamped on your records. The penalty for lacking moral fiber was court-martial, because it was considered a character issue. So as we've had to wrestle with language and belief about those behaviors, if you fled, if you fell, if you fainted, if you wouldn't shoot, you were considered to have an issue of character. But that's also how we collectively looked at those behaviors, you know. And I think it's not far to leap into today and say, how do we look at some other behaviors? Very likely 20 years from now, we're going to look back and say, oh, we thought that illness was a character issue, or we thought that behavior was a character issue.
So these letters that he sent, did he end up finding an advocate?
He did. He found two really surprising advocates. His letter to the law school at Penn was put into, of course, you know, prisoners all the time write to lawyers, help me, and, you know, I'm the innocent party, that kind of thing. So it was in a box. Two first-year law students randomly picked his letter out of a box, and because his hospital was only a few hours from Philadelphia, they said, well, we'll go up and see this guy. And I got to interview these two. They were just wonderful, and what I love is they're still doing social justice work today, and they credit that experience. But they said, we were so green and so young, and we really didn't know what we were doing, that the hospital let us in. They looked like kids, and they came in as young attorneys and preparing to be attorneys, and when they interviewed Donald, they thought, this is a test case, certainly, to test both the diagnosis and the penalty of all those years. And the case that they made was, if he had truly been charged with these crimes, he would have been given X number of years with an expiration date and not locked up forever. And they also brought Thomas Zaws in, who questioned what insanity is, in fact, and began to introduce that language of trauma being something other than insanity. Mm-hmm. And they made their case. And then the other shocking part of the story is then Donald was very quickly released after all those years, a man who had very little stability, the horror of being a Marine in China, coming home, committing murders, the horror of the hospital. And then they said, there's the door. Good luck with that. You know, so then he had to organize again.
So can you talk a little about how, I guess, how as a culture we've made this transition from that lack of moral fiber framework to the PTSD framework that we have today?
Right. I think it is fair to say and true to say we have been wrestling with this. All humans have been wrestling. We know trauma, if you lose that language, goes back to Greek wars. All of those Greek writers wrote afterward about the strange behaviors of their men coming home, the dissociation, the nightmares. You know, we see that in the Odyssey and the Iliad. They are describing traumatized veterans. So, and even these terms that we use, I like to remind people, that's the best we had at the time. Railway spine was the best diagnosis we had because you could see the person shaking and we didn't know what else was going on. So I always say this is a work in progress. I mean, we have gone from post-traumatic stress disorder to post-traumatic stress injury to remind ourselves that this is an injury, again, not a character disorder. And, you know, the language is even moving forward. The track that runs beside this, though, that makes it very challenging is there's an economic issue here that is invisible to many of us, and that is all diagnoses, medical diagnoses, psychological diagnoses, are coded. And so medical illnesses have codes when we go to the doctor. You know, the doctor's looking at a chart and putting a code next to it. And the American Psychological Association has a book of codes called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. We can only afford as a country to treat so many people with so many things at a time. So there's a decision made every 5 years what diagnoses we will count or not count. And when I learned about that and understood it, I realized this is economic, that we are making collectively a decision about who we will support, heal, or help.
And then do you think that these changes in our psychological understanding of trauma, have they been reflected in our more broader institutional frameworks for dealing with it?
I think it's coming. I think this is a little bit slower because we have thought of trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder as purely psychological, kind of like you got to wrap your head around that, you got to change your mind. We know now, and we were just talking earlier, one of the great researchers in this is Bessel van der Kolk, who from the Trauma Center in Boston, who has worked with all kinds of trauma survivors. And he was the first one to say it's not from the neck up, that you need the body in this healing as well. And in fact, this is sort of startling, the United States Army is the biggest investor in yoga research right now. You know, it's not Kripalu Center and the yoga centers, because they're wrestling. It is an economic issue for them that those soldiers get back to the front or back to work or not have to pay for that expensive treatment later. So they are looking at all of these alternative treatments, because we also know it's the body. You know, we have to throw away that body-mind split, especially around trauma.
Mm, yeah, and in a weird way, the military can be very progressive in terms of, like, dealing with global warming or PTSD, or, like, my dad passed away from ALS, and they have a double the incidence of ALS as to the normal population, right. And so they automatically cover it.
Right, so. And they have the budget, so there's that other economic piece.
But we need to tie this up. So on this Memorial Day, is there anything that you'd like to share with veterans who are still dealing with these difficulties?
Yes, absolutely. For veterans and their families, because a lot of times it is easier for the family member is going to identify it first. They're going to see unusual behavior, depression, withdrawal, some of those traditional symptoms for them to get help. But also one of the things that we know for sure is trauma is healed in community. And so whether that's a marching band or a singing group, that's a good first step. And then also especially finding other veterans who are the ones who will understand the experience.
That's so important, that community thing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then is there anything else that we've missed that you want to share about trauma more broadly in the world right now?
Well, I think to understand, you know, and it is the human condition and the culture and political condition, we are creators of trauma. At the same time, we are committed to healing it. So I think being mindful of where in our systems, in our structures, we are traumatizing or slowing that healing and to keep that conversation alive.
Mm. Right. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
That was award-winning author and Unity House Development Director Diane Cameron sharing with us her book Never Leave Your Dead and her perspectives on military trauma. For those just tuning in, I'm Dave Pueblo.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
Next up, Ayad Al-Gharabi is a member of the Palestinian Youth Movement and the founding member of the Queer Palestinian Empowerment Network, a Palestinian diaspora organization working to amplify the voices of queer Palestinians. Jonah Moberg met with him to hear his experiences.
You're the founding member of the Queer Palestinian Empowerment Network.
Yep.
Could you talk a little bit about what the mission is and why you founded it?
So throughout my career of organizing, I've seen groups exist like Queers Against Israeli Apartheid, Queers Against Occupation, Queers Against this and that. I haven't seen an organization in this side of the pond dedicated to LGBT Palestinians, and that's why I thought of QPEN, because there's a need for a space for LGBT Palestinians to be heard and seen. So we have twofold. We do internal stuff, which I won't get into, internal empowerment, deal with Palestinian stuff as queer Palestinians. Externally, we'll engage in BDS work, LGBT work, LGBT Palestinian work, and work in empowering our members to engage in civil society.
Yeah, considering the climate in the U.S. around Middle Eastern issues in general, it might be useful to talk about, to address, some people might be surprised to hear, some Americans might be surprised to hear about a queer organization coming out of Palestine, or a queer organization that's being run by people who are Muslim. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about those misconceptions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there are several LGBT Palestinian groups in Palestine. QPEN is this side of the pond, comrade, because QPEN covers Canada and North America. So QPEN covers, you know, LGBT Palestinians in the diaspora, queer Palestinians in the diaspora. There are 3 to 4 organizations dedicated to Palestinians who are LGBT in the West Bank. I don't know if there are any in Gaza, probably, but in the West Bank, there's a couple. There's one called Al-Kaus, which is a great organization that really talks about coming out and dealing with all that situation within Palestinian civil society and the Palestinian household. But your other question?
I was wondering if you could speak to the relationship between Islam and the queer community and the overlap there. And because I know a lot of people in America think of Islam as a conservative religion and have a hard time understanding that queerness and Islam can overlap.
Right. So part of the misconception is that they probably think that every Muslim is ISIS, which is not true. Or every single Arab country, or every single Palestinian country push people off of rooftops. Never. Never have a Palestinian society pushed an LGBT Palestinian off a rooftop. Palestinians don't do that. Yes. Every single country has homophobia, transphobia, sexism. Every single civil society, every single country on this earth has homophobia. There is no... I haven't seen one country doesn't have homophobia or hatred. Like, this country still doesn't have the Employment and Discrimination Act. This New York State doesn't have gender. So let's just get that out there that no one's perfect. In fact, this country is not perfect when it comes to LGBT rights.
Right.
Every religion, every monotheist religion has work to be done. Muslims in America are not as aggressive and homophobic as others. Mainly the most homophobic folks in this country are, you know, right-wing Christians and sometimes liberals, I guess. But there's work to be done. And there are a lot of LGBT Muslims in America that do a lot of good work and try to have conversations with other Muslims about the structure of being both and navigating through that. For me, it's an intense process because mainly from the view of folks who don't believe I'm a human being for being Palestinian or Muslim. And then the next thing you know, they say offensive things like, oh, if you were in Gaza, you'd be killed. Oh, if you're in the West Bank, you'd be killed. And I'm like, if there was a gay bar in Gaza, it would be bombed. If there was an LGBT bar in the West Bank, it would be bombed and raided all the time. Not because we're that, not because we're queer or LGBT, it's because we're Palestinian. It might be because we're queer and LGBT as well, from Israel, you know? But it's, being honest, every monotheistic religion, there needs to be worked on. But there is space for the LGBT Muslims. There are space. One of the organizations I would look to, if you hear this, is Masjid, which is you know, a Muslim LGBT organization based in D.C., but it's a national thing.
What was the name again?
Masjid, M-A-S-J-G-D.
Cool.
It's Muslims who are sexually diverse and have gender diversity.
Cool. So yeah, I want to sort of pull it back a little bit to the Queer Palestinian Empowerment Network and talk about what your experience has been like founding that organization. What was the response from the community, and what kind of work do you do?
My experiences were intense because we'd done some of the important work that was done. I helped organize the Creating Change protests in 2015. And as a member of QPEN and the founder of QPEN, I went through some stuff. For example, I was staying at a member, I was staying in a community house where the person who housed me actually was a member of the Jewish Defense League. And they didn't know I was Palestinian queer. They just knew that I was LGBT. And then they just made up lies about me. Which I didn't do. I didn't talk about them bad. Now I am, but I didn't before. And, you know, they had JDL flags flying around, driving around, asking me to leave. Very passive aggressively. But basically, the Creating Change demonstration was intense because a lot of LGBT people of color were attacked. And, you know, that organization, Creating Change, brought, you know, the Zionists back and really didn't talk to me, didn't talk to any other LGBT Palestinian, and doing a space, conference space, to have us have our conversation. Now, if people were interested in having a debate or a conversation, I would have been okay with that. But a wider bridge is an organization that tries to defend Israel and try to bridge a gap between Israel and the U.S. and just make up lies about BDS, make up the lies about Palestinian queers, and it's just wrong. I've been a part of a lot of iconic conversations about what we've done. You know, as part of the QPEN was part of the accountability rallies at Netroots Nation towards Bernie Sanders. We were part of that. We were supporting all in that. We helped interrupt Pride stuff. And I think that QPEN might make an appearance at Pride. I don't know if we're going to table or march, but I think if anyone wants to march with QPEN, just message us on Facebook. Right now, we're trying to focus on LGBT organizations who talk about justice, talk about rights, and don't really talk about Palestinian queers. And we also were trying to engage with people who are LGBT to understand that Palestinian queers exist. And we're trying to get folks realize that you can be the margins within the margins within the margins. Right now, we're trying to build a website, get new merch, you know, work on a conference, work on an internal conference, an external conference. So follow us on Twitter, Queer Pally Empower Us, and we're on Facebook.
Wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like folks to know or you'd like to get out there about either your organizations or about the situation in Palestine at the moment?
Yes. Please like PYM on Facebook, the Palestinian Youth Movement on Facebook. Please like QPEN and follow us on Twitter and follow us PYM on Twitter. And also this Friday, we're going to have a protest on May 18th, this Friday.
18th.
Around 4 p.m., I believe, and it's going to be in front of the Schumer's office. And keep watching the local area. We might do some protests, too. We might incorporate with Ramadan and Iftar. So thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me.
That was Iyad Al-Gharabi of the Queer Palestinian Empowerment Network.
In our next segment, WOOC correspondent Lois Gundrum speaks to Ryan Rose and Jesse Marshall, co-owners of Capital Bookkeeping Cooperative, about their unique business and an upcoming workshop on sociocracy that they are sponsoring in June.
Jesse, would you tell us a little bit about the Capital Bookkeeping Cooperative and the kinds of services it provides?
Sure. So CBC is a worker-owned company that provides bookkeeping, systems creation, and financial management services to all kinds of small businesses. We help a lot of people starting out get set up in accounting software for the first time and think through their business plans and budgets. We also consult with larger companies to make their administrative systems more transparent and efficient. And we do, you know, good old-fashioned data entry, pay bills, cut checks, send out invoices, that kind of stuff. Basically, whatever a small business owner needs help with so they can focus on doing what they care about.
That's great. Ryan, your business is structured as a co-op. What does that mean?
So in New York State, it is its own corporate designation. We are a worker cooperative corporation. So not an S-corp or an LLC, a worker cooperative. And what that means is that we are a for-profit business owned and democratically controlled by the people that work there. The workers can actually get together and decide how we're governed, what to do with any profits at the end of the year, whether they're distributed as a patronage dividend, and we essentially make all of our own policy decisions.
That sounds like a very motivating reason for people to work with you. What is the mission of Capital Bookkeeping Cooperative?
To create jobs and a pathway to ownership for people from different walks of life. This means growing our business to include more worker owners and eventually helping to start and support other cooperatives in the Capital District.
And I'll just add on that we really started this business because we saw, you know, a need, a way to create jobs for ourselves and others. But then we also saw that these same services were probably what other working people would need to help create livelihoods that they had control over, that they owned. So we're hoping that once we're established and have grown a little bit, we'll be able to take these same services and really help to support other worker-owned businesses.
In a few weeks, you're going to be sponsoring a workshop about sociocracy. Would you tell us what is sociocracy and how did you become interested in it?
Sure. So we first heard about sociocracy at a conference in Buffalo, actually, in 2016, organized by the New Economy Coalition, which is a great national organization if you're interested in this kind of stuff. And sociocracy is a method for designing and governing organizations to make sure that they're inclusive, efficient, and adaptive. So it's really two things at once. It's a way to structure organizations into small groups that are well coordinated and focused, but within the groups, within the teams, they're autonomous. So they're able to organize their own work, assign roles to members. It uses something called consent decision making, which is somewhere between majority rule and consensus, which is something we'll get into more at the workshop. And it really is designed to make sure that information and power flows up and down the organization so that, you know, decisions get made, other parts of the organization know about them, and the effects are measured and sort of feedback into future decision-making processes.
For those of you who have just tuned in, this is WOOC 105.3 FM, and we are talking with Jesse Marshall and Ryan Rose, co-owners of Capital Bookkeeping Cooperative. So this workshop that you just mentioned is entitled Empowerment, Effectiveness, Adaptation, and Intro to Sociology. Would you tell us a little more about the workshop?
Sure. There are not many experts in the United States who are familiar with this form of governance or organization known as sociocracy. There are some consultants out there who do charge for their service, but we are going to be bringing in a group from Amherst, Massachusetts called Sociocracy for All. They are a nonprofit, and they're the only nonprofit that currently operates in the United States offering educational services on this model. So our lead facilitator, teacher, organizer, Jerry Koch Gonzalez. He is one of the co-founders of this organization called Sociocracy for All. And he'll be taking us through the basics, and our workshop will be June 16th, 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. at the Oakwood Community Center in Troy, New York.
Even though the term sociocracy is unfamiliar to many of us, I know I had never heard of it before I met you two, you feel that the principles learned in this workshop are going to be very practical and useful for many people. So would you please give us some examples of how people might be able to benefit from this workshop?
Sure. I, like many other people that I know, have been in a number of situations where I'm either working with a group on a grassroots issue or working in a large organization like the Honest Weight Food Co-op. And you seem to find yourself in these situations where you're in a meeting, you're trying to organize something, people are talking in circles, things kind of spiral out of control, tasks don't get assigned. There's a lot of time and energy that gets wasted when you don't have a good foundation and a good format to follow. And what this does is, you know, creates a system for people to organize the work. If it's a project or something like that, if people are looking to start an organization, it provides a step-by-step process for setting an organization up that's going to distribute power fairly equally by creating these semi-autonomous groups, divvying up the tasks that need to be done and creating roles and nominating people to those positions so that the work does get done and it doesn't just get talked about or left out.
Yeah, and I would just add sort of a little context. This was developed in the 1970s in the Netherlands by an electrical engineer, actually, who was informed by his experience in a Quaker high school that was started by a well-known peace activist that was basically governed by its students. So he sort of merged that Quaker perspective with his really like systems thinking, systems theory of his profession to create this system. And since then, it's been adapted and, you know, modified by groups all over the world. There are big corporations that use versions of this, all the way down to, you know, I've Skyped with an eco-village in Brazil that uses this system. And I know about a lot of worker co-ops in the U.S., a lot of co-housing communities, a retirement community, schools use it. So it's really, you know, it's proven and it's working in a lot of different contexts.
So how do people sign up for this workshop? It sounds so interesting.
Great question. So we have a Facebook event for the workshop. So if you get on Facebook and search for Capital Bookkeeping Cooperative, you'll find our page right away and there will be details there. Tickets are available through Eventbrite, so you can link to that on the Facebook page, or you can go to troysociocracy.eventbrite.com. And that's sociocracy is spelled S-O-C-I-O-C-R-A-C-Y.
And on Friday night, before the workshop itself, you're having a gathering with Jerry, the leader of the workshop. So would you give us some details about that?
Sure. So for people who can't make the full day or who just, you know, can't get enough, and I definitely recommend coming to both, we're having a less formal gathering, again, at Oakwood Community Center, which is at 313 10th Street in Troy. That's from 6 to 9 p.m. We'll have some just social time. We'll have a potluck, so, you know, bring something or you know, eat what you want. And then we'll spend an hour or two actually doing some really fun hands-on exercises around sociocracy. So we'll be getting up and moving and kind of embodying the principles with our bodies. So it should be really fun.
Is there anything else that you two would like to share with the listeners about the workshop or anything?
Well, I'll just mention that our website is capitalbookkeeping.coop, so .coop, and we love to hear from anyone who's interested in this stuff.
Thank you both. Thank you both for being with us.
Yeah. That was WOOC correspondent Lois Gundrum speaking with Jesse Marshall and Ryan Rose, co-owners of Capital Bookkeeping Cooperative, telling us about an upcoming workshop on sociocracy, a shared, decentralized approach to decision-making that has many useful applications. And that concludes the show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Dave Pueblo.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. Remember to tune back in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your recommended daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
And as a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org, or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.